Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and I'm joined, as always, by Lahav Harkov. And in this week's edition, we're going to talk about hot issues and topics that have been leading the news this past week for Israel, whether it's the Taliban taking over Afghanistan, the new crisis with Poland over restitution laws that will deny Jews the right and ability to file suits that would demand back property that was lost during the horrific times and days of the Holocaust. But before we jump into those really tough issues, Lahav, I did want to talk to you a bit about, and usually we do our tweet of the week maybe later in the show, but there was a tweet the other day of the former Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's traveling to the United States with his wife, Sarah, and his son, Yair, which is all a separate question. I don't know if when you were 30, you were going on vacation still with your parents, but we can talk about that another time. But they're sitting in an airport in San Francisco, apparently, on their way to a vacation. Everyone starts to attack them, right, on Twitter. People are, you know, oh, look at him. He's no longer the leader of Israel. He's just sitting on his suitcases like anyone else is sitting on their suitcases as they wait in line to check in or whatever it might be. And, you know, to me, it kind of felt that leave the guy alone. He's going on vacation. He deserves a vacation. He was prime minister for 12 years consecutively. I had a lot of criticism of him. A lot of other people had criticism of him. But I think that we can all agree that he probably deserves some time off, a little break to be with his family. Whether we liked him as a prime minister or we didn't like him as prime minister, I think we can back off. And that just bothered me.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. You know, totally fully deserves a vacation. I think there was also something very jarring to see a picture of Netanyahu sitting on his suitcases and waiting in line like everyone else, you know, because we're so used to seeing him. And I think he wants to push this image of him being sort of like in some sort of higher plane of existence, you know, that he is the great leader. So it is a little bit strange to see him sort of coming down to earth like that.
That's how democracies work. Once you're up, once you're down. I mean, that's how it goes.
Listen, even as prime minister, right, we have like that legendary picture of like Menachem Begin on a plane putting his wife's slippers on her feet and things like that. You know, we like modest prime ministers in Israel as well. But it was just a very different picture of him. But I think the thing that people are upset about is that the government is trying to send a message to Israelis that they should not be traveling abroad while the Delta variant is spreading, and that as leader of the opposition, he should also be setting that example. So he could have taken his vacation to Eilat or the Golan or any number of lovely places inside Israel.
I hear that. And even with that said, I think that he is a private person who has the right to vacation as he would like. Of course, if there was a lockdown and he wasn't able to travel and he still found a way to travel, that would be a different situation. But as long as the airport's open, as long as flights are open and available, he has the right to take it. And I think that people also need to back off a little from constantly scrutinizing every single thing that he does. I think that we, to an extent, especially in the media, and parts of this country still have this Bibi obsession that we haven't been able to get over yet. And everything that, for example, Bennett does is constantly be compared to Bibi. Everything that Netanyahu says, everywhere he goes, what he eats, what the videos he makes. I mean, we also have to kind of start to put him into the proper context. He's the head of opposition. Not everything that he does should interest us.
In fact, very few things he does really should interest us if I'm comparing it to past leaders of the opposition.
For sure. Now, on the Likud, though, on that front, since we're already talking about Bibi and the Likud, there was quite the challenge that was thrown out this past weekend by someone who was seen for a while as one of his close associates and confidants, Miri Regev. Former IDF spokesperson, turned Likud member in 2009, became a Likud minister, now is still a member of the Likud. And she pulled the ethnic genie out of the bottle to basically call for the Likud members to stop voting for white people and to, literally that's how she said it, Lavan, white yeah. people, and to vote for a Mizrahi / Sephardi leader of the party. Of course, herself is the natural candidate, she said. What's going on there? What's going on in that party?
Oh, I have so much to say about this topic. Likud has, Likud has traditionally been a party that has very strong representation for the Mizrahi, meaning the Middle Eastern and North African population of Israel, many of whom justifiably felt that they had been discriminated against by the labor establishment in the first sort of 30 years of Israel's existence. And the Likud, and you hear people talking about it to this day, some very old people or some people just talking about what their parents felt, that, you know, the Likud opened their chapters across the country to to Israelis, no matter where they or their parents came from, and allowed them to have an equal say and to participate in the party's activities. And really, when Menachem Begin was elected prime minister in 1977, it was in large part because of that support. And that support has continued over the decades since then, even though now there's Shas, for example. So Likud and Shas do compete for a certain segment of those votes, for example. What I found frustrating about what Regev said, it's on a few levels. First of all, I really don't like taking the parlance of American racial issues and bringing them into Israel. You know, this isn't about skin color. Regev herself doesn't have particularly dark skin. To give another example of someone in Likud who's of Moroccan origin and is very prominent, Dudi Amsalem is probably as white as I am. I've only ever seen him with white hair, but he looks like someone who might have even been blonde. And so, you know, it's just like nonsense to pretend that it's about black and white necessarily. There are, of course, lingering tensions and discrimination against people of Mizrahi origin, also of Ethiopian origin. You know, we can't deny that these things sort of exist socially. And the fact is that there have only ever been Ashkenazi male leaders of Likud. She is right about that. But I don't like that her adopting that language. And the other thing is that I think she really does a disservice, as she and others, Dudi Amsalem, who I mentioned, for example, do a disservice by pretending that their attitude and their personality equals Mizrahi people. The two of them, and we're really talking about Miri Regev, she's a very shouty. She uses a lot of name calling and personal insults. She often uses the political tactic of really just being really, really disrespectful to the people that she disagrees with. And they pretend that this is part of their like hot Mizrahi temper. And I just feel like, look at someone like Moshe Kahlon. Like, he's not in politics anymore, but he was a rising star in Likud. This is somebody whose parents came from Libya, was born into really abject poverty, one of the poorest neighborhoods and crime-ridden in Israel, in the town of Hadera, and lifted himself up out of it and became a leading figure in Likud, broke off of Likud to form his own political party and became finance minister. And he is one of the most pleasant people you will ever meet. He is not a shouter. He is not a name caller. He is known for his friendly smile that he has for everyone. And he is no less Mizrahi than Miri Regev. And if we're going to call it black and white, his skin is a lot darker than hers. Really don't think that that's the point. And so I just find that incredibly like, it's almost like, you know, bringing Mizrahi down by pretending that her behavior is the exemplar of Mizrahi-ness.
I agree with a lot of what you said. I mean, Miri Regev, I haven't been a fan for a long time. I think that she really exemplifies a lot of what's wrong with Israeli politics over the last few years. And it's astounding in my eyes that she was once upon a time the chief military censor and was the holder of state secrets. And now this is the way she behaves, whether it's calling African migrants, many of them refugees, a cancer, to other comments that she's made over the years. But let's be honest, and let's just call this what it really is. This is an attempt to create social divisions within Israel, to try to create racial tension within Israel for one purpose and one purpose only, to advance her political career. Right. That's what this is. And by the way, there are journalists who do this. There's one prominent journalist on Channel 13, Avishai Ben Chaim, who talks about Yisrael HaRishona and Yisrael HaShniya, right? The first Israel, or first class Israel, the second class Israel, and pushes very strongly this idea that if you are Ashkenazi, you are part of the first class of Israel. If you're Sephardi, you're part of the second class of Israel. And I also think, Lahav, like you said, I mean, we also do have to be frank and honest. I mean, you and I are both immigrants to this country, coming from the West. But, you know, we've been here long enough to know that there still is a discrimination against certain segments of this country. Mizrahim still do feel that they have a longer, higher ladder that they have to climb to be able to advance themselves. So is Israel perfect? No. But is this the way to try to solve that problem? Of course not, right? And I think that what she's doing is just, it's such cynical politics that only causes damage to the delicate fabric that makes up Israeli society. And that's why it's disturbing to me. But again, she's trying to advance her own political career. That's what it is.
Yeah, and among the people who, you know, are probably running for Likud leader, I do think she is the only... She's the only woman and the only person who's not Ashkenazi. I mean, you look at the other people, like Yuli Edelstein, Nir Barkat, Yisrael Katz. So she's different from them in that way. So, yeah, I mean, she's right. Going to make this her ticket. You know, this is going to be her campaign.
But what I wanted to ask you, though, Lahav, is that, you know, she explicitly says in the interview, I'm only going to run for head of Likud in the era after Netanyahu, right? So after Netanyahu is no longer head of Likud. That's kind of what they all said. Barkat says that's what they all kind of say the same thing. But if everyone, like I was thinking about this, like if you and other reporters at the newspaper said, listen, I want to be editor after Yaakov is editor, right? And everyone starts to talk about this, right, publicly. I would start to think, okay, everyone wants me to leave, right? So if Netanyahu is hearing everyone talking about how they want to replace him the day after, that might be a sign of weakness. No, they're smelling his blood. They get that maybe his time has come.
I definitely think that's it. And I heard from one of these contenders not so long ago that he thinks that Netanyahu will leave in the next year or so and will go off to business because being opposition leader is sort of a thankless job. So they certainly think that Netanyahu is weak. And that, you know, they'll be rid of him soon. I think, you know, I've been saying this for years, even while Netanyahu was still prime minister, that the moment that Netanyahu leaves Likud, there's going to be a bloodbath. That party is going to tear itself apart. And we'll see if it can survive the post-Netanyahu era because they've become so strongly identified with him. And the thing that makes me think that the party will eventually survive is that, it might be the only party in Israel that has very, very strong sort of chapters across the country that actually meet. And there's like sort of a social element and camaraderie to it. And so that might keep it together in the end. But it's going to be rough.
Interesting. So, Lahav, we got a lot more to talk about. I mean, one thing that we're going to talk with Ephraim Zuroff in a bit, who's, I think, still goes by the title of Nazi Hunter. Works with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, I think the director of their office here in Israel. And we're going to talk to him about this new Polish law that was signed into legislation by President Duda earlier this week or over the weekend. President Duda actually had the opportunity to meet in Warsaw a couple years ago after the last time we had a diplomatic tension with the Poles. It was an interesting interview. He's definitely a nationalist. He is feeding into that narrative. What was the best part of this, I think I told you, was that at the end of the interview, which was held in Polish with an interpreter, because I don't speak it, he pulls me aside as we were kind of saying our goodbyes and whispers into my ear, you know, my wife's family is Jewish and even had ancestors who perished in the Holocaust. And I was wondering, why is he whispering this just to me and not saying it publicly? But we'll get to that with Zuroff later. We're also going to talk with Annie Ehrenheim, our military correspondent, about the lessons that can be learned from the hasty withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan and the very quick takeover of the Taliban of that country. And what is it? What does Israel potentially have to learn from this? What can the world maybe learn from Israel's past withdrawals? But we also had that fire the other day at the same time that this was going on in Afghanistan. I remember looking out the window of my office with this huge cloud of smoke overtaking Jerusalem. People were calling it the Armageddon. At the same time, there seemed to be a true disaster taking place in Afghanistan. So we're going to talk a bit about that with Annie.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked about climate last week, but these wildfires are going to keep getting worse and worse. The fire department the fire chief in Israel thinks that it was started by a person. They don't know if it was arson or if it was an accident. But either way, because of the dryness and because of the warmer climate, they're, you know, worse than they ever have been before. So that was definitely a scary sight to see. But we will now go forward with our guests.
Ephraim Zuroff, thank you.
We have on the show Chief Nazi Hunter and head of the Jerusalem office of the Simon Wiesenthal Center and historian Ephraim Zuroff to talk with us about the restitution or the anti-restitution law in Poland and just the general atmosphere in Poland and Eastern Europe when it comes to the issues of Holocaust remembrance. So thank you for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Could you just tell our listeners a little bit about what this new law in Poland means for Holocaust survivors and their descendants?
The practical implication of this law is that it'll be practically impossible for anyone to regain property that once belonged to their families and was confiscated during the Shoah.
So the statute of limitation, right, to appeal, I guess, or to put into to regain the property that was confiscated is 30 years. And of course, the communism fell across Eastern Europe 30 years ago. So people have like, what, like 2 weeks till the law comes into play to even be able to apply. So there's in Poland, there's no reason to even look into it anymore, you're saying.
Well, what the Poles are saying is that it means that they can turn to civil courts, but everyone knows, I mean, the people who are well-informed on these issues know that those courts have been very adverse to the restitution of property as taken over during the Holocaust to Jews. In other words, adverse to granting the Jews the property back.
What's the motivation behind this, right? I mean, is it financial? They don't want to have to pay Jews to give them back the financial value of whatever their property was? Is it a nationalistic issue? Right. We know that, for example, that the Poles have a big problem with any reference to Polish death camps, right? Because they it's very important for them that it's clear that these were Nazi camps that were built in Poland. What's the real motivation? Is it anti-Semitism? That it's just about Jews? What are they after here?
Listen, first of all, it's a combination of a lot of things. I mean, their insistence on preventing the use of the term Polish death camps is actually justified. Those camps were not built by Poles. They were on Polish soil. Poland was occupied, and the Poles didn't serve there. As a matter of fact, in some of the camps, like in Auschwitz and Majdanek, there were quite a few Polish prisoners in these camps. So that's really justified. But the issue is completely is different. In other words, they are denying any involvement in Holocaust crimes. Now, first of all, when the 2018 bill originally was passed, it said anyone who attributes Holocaust crimes to the Polish state is liable to face criminal charges. Now, first of all, the Polish state did not exist during World War II. There was a government in exile, and that government in exile did not encourage the murder of Jews and had nothing to do with participation in the murder of Jews. But the problem was that Poland was a very anti-Semitic country. As a matter of fact, let's say if we leave Germany out of the equation, Poland was probably the most anti-Semitic country in Europe before World War II. This found expression was reflected by the fact that many Poles murdered Jews or turned over Jews to the Gestapo to be murdered. And the estimate today by some very good Polish historians is that approximately 200,000 Jews were either murdered by Poles or turned Jews over to the Gestapo, to the SS, to be murdered. So this was not the Polish government. This was not a Polish organization. But there's no question that Poles played an important role. And this is also reflected in thousands of testimonies from Polish survivors who pointed to the animosity that they faced and in some cases the murders that they witnessed of Jews by Poles. So this is something that the Poles want to deny. They refuse to relate to it. And that's one aspect. The other aspect is, of course, financial. because in many Polish cities, Jews were a significant segment of the percentage of the population. And some of the real estate that they had was in the center of town and could be, you know, valuable even today. So it's a combination of basically this refusal to face the past, element of anti-Semitism, a financial element, and it's a pretty pretty poisonous package, I would say to you.
So far, Minister Yair Lapid has been accusing the Polish government basically of passing, of this new restitution law being anti-Semitic and being a form of Holocaust denial. And some have said, you know, that this new law is different sort of from the old law. Do you make that differentiation, or do you agree with Lapid that the new law is as well sort of distorting the Holocaust?
No, there's no question that this is part of a much larger issue, which is the manner in which the Polish government, and we're talking about a right-wing government, which the governing party is Law and Justice, and its whole conception, the whole narrative that has a World War II, wants to emphasize Polish victimhood, which is true. In other words, the Poles suffered terribly under the Nazis, and they were barely a notch above the Jews. They were also considered Untermenschen, or subhumans. And that's what they want to emphasize. And they don't want to in any way touch the very sensitive and very horrible issue of their own, of the collaboration of Poles in the crimes of the Shoah. So, first of all, I want to say that Yair Lapid's response to this issue is a breath of fresh air coming from the foreign ministry, because during the previous government, which to a certain extent neutralized the foreign ministry, but Netanyahu made very clear that he was not going to call out the countries of Eastern Europe who were denying the role that their nationals played in the murder of Jews and the persecution and murder of Jews. And the fact that Israel was basically giving them a green light only encouraged them to continue with this false narrative. I mean, this is a very, very sad story. When Netanyahu went to, I'll give you an example, a very blatant example. When Netanyahu visited Lithuania in 2018, not only did he not engage the government in some sort of dialogue to see if something could be done, you know, explain to them that it's simply unacceptable to hide the crimes of the Lithuanians, who, many of whom zealously participated in the mass murder of their Jewish neighbors, but he praised them for the way they were commemorating Shoah. I mean, this is absolutely absurd. It's like praising the Ku Klux Klan for improving race relations in the United States. This is absolutely crazy. But of course, if Israel doesn't complain, so yalla, we can continue with our lives, with our very comfortable lives.
Is Morawiecki, who's the prime minister, Duda, who's the president, right? These are, you know, you mentioned the politics here. It seems that there is a lot of what's happening here is politics, right? There's this nationalist effort and movement to play up their own suffering, the regular Polish suffering, to kind of push aside the Jewish suffering and the millions of Jews who lived in Poland and many of who were slaughtered during the Shoah. But is this something that the whole Jewish world needs to be up in arms about, or is it something that just Israel needs to deal with on a diplomatic level?
I would say to you that the whole Jewish world should be up in arms about it. And basically what they want to do is the following. But before I list those goals, I want to remind you of something, a historical fact that is super important. Only in Eastern Europe did collaboration with the Nazis include participation in systematic mass murder. In other words, in every country that was occupied by or allied with Nazi Germany, the Nazis tried to enlist local helpers. And there were three reasons: one ideological reason and two practical reasons. The ideological reason was that they wanted to show that the local population supports the measures that they were going to take against the quote-unquote enemies of the Reich. Obviously, primarily the Jews, but also homosexuals, gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, mentally ill, physically ill, etc. Okay? Now, the practical reasons were the following. First of all, the Nazis were shorthanded. They controlled an area, almost the entire European continent, with the exception of Great Britain, and the six neutrals. The neutrals were Turkey, Switzerland, Sweden, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal. Every other country was either occupied by Nazi Germany or allied with Nazi Germany. From the beaches of Normandy in the west to the gates of Moscow and Leningrad, from Narvik and Trondheim in Norway in the north, all the way down to the Greek islands. They're about to launch an unprecedented murder operation. They come to a country like Lithuania, for example, or Ukraine. They don't know the language. They don't know the topography. The original way that the Final Solution was implemented was not gas chambers and death camps. It was shooting, mass shootings. In other words, every single Jew, or in Lithuania, 90% of the Jews who were murdered, and we're talking about some 200,000 victims, had to be murdered individually. The same in Latvia initially, the same in Estonia, the same in Belarus and Ukraine. That's incredibly labor-intensive task. In Lithuania, during the Nazi occupation, there were less than 1,000 Germans. How on earth could they murder so many people in such a short time by shooting?
They got the locals, yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's the part that is very painful for these people because, you know, when the World War II was over, they didn't become liberal democracies. They switched the Nazi occupation for a communist occupation, which, by the way, also distorted the history of the Holocaust and never acknowledged the fact that Jews had been singled out for murder, for example, right, as one of the distortions. So, you know, in the beginning, these countries were rather cautious. In other words, from the very beginning, it was clear that these countries are going to produce a very questionable narrative. And I'll give you one example that stands out in my mind very clearly. In 1991, mm-hmm. there was a dedication of a monument at Ponar. Ponar was the site of the murder of 70,000 Jews, mostly from Vilna, but also from other places. And the keynote speaker was the Prime Minister of Lithuania, Gediminas Vagnorius. And he said something about the Holocaust lasting only 3 months, like an eye blink. And then he said that the reputation of a country in which the locals provided so much help for the victims cannot be smeared or cannot be besmirched by the crimes of a few social miscasts, a few marginal elements of society. Now, I was present at this ceremony, and the speech was being translated. And there were many Jews there, many Israelis there, and we all looked at each other and, you know, as if, what the hell is going on here? What's he talking about? So in the beginning, they were somewhat careful because they were afraid that if they really went too far, it might block their entry to the European Union and NATO. But when they saw that neither NATO nor the European Union was particularly perturbed by this, so, yeah, and that Israel didn't care, was giving them a green light in a sense. So they really went to town, and they basically their four goals to what they're doing. This is not only in Lithuania. This is in Latvia. This is in Estonia, in Croatia, Hungary, Romania, you name it. Practically every single country in post-communist East Europe. So one is to minimize or hide the role played by the locals. Two is to claim that communist crimes are just as bad or even worse than Nazi crimes, and the crimes committed by the communists are actually genocide. Now, this is extremely important because if they were genocide, which they weren't, okay, that means that Jews committed genocide because there were Jews among the communists who participated in the crimes against the peoples of Eastern Europe. In other words, if everyone is guilty, no one is guilty. The third point is that these new democracies are in search of heroes. So who are the heroes in post-communist Eastern Europe? The people who fought against the Soviets after World War II, which is understandable. And it's fine, except for one reason. Some of those people murdered Jews or helped murder Jews during the Shoah, which in theory should disqualify these people from being national heroes and having their lives glorified by the authorities, by the government. So today you have statues and plaques and all sorts of awards given to these people. And I mean, it's horrific. What is?
So I want to just bring us back to what's happening in the last.
Last point is they're pushing for a Memorial Day for all the victims of totalitarian regimes. In other words, communism and Nazism. And should they, God forbid, succeed, that would make International Holocaust Day superfluous. In other words, a day for all victims of totalitarian regimes would encompass more victims, make more people happy, perhaps. But
yeah, it's interesting because right a couple of years ago, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau wrote some sort of statement that had lumped everyone together, and there was a big uproar. But in these other countries, it's only when they, you know, periodically do something even more outrageous that it gets attention. But I wanted to ask you, so Lapid has made these angry statements, and he's gotten Bennett on board as well, and they've recalled Israel's senior diplomat in Poland. There's not an ambassador there at the moment, and Israel's not going to send its ambassador anytime soon, etc. Now that we've expressed our anger, what should Israel be doing moving forward? And also, Lapid says he's working with Secretary of State Blinken. So what should the U.S. be doing moving forward?
Listen, I think that it's extremely important to enter into a serious dialogue with these countries regarding the issues of education, of documentation, of the narrative. In other words, to finally get them to face the past. In other words, we're in a situation today where when there's all practice, almost no perpetrators left to bring to justice, okay? So we're not going after these people's grandparents anymore. And the people who are alive today are not guilty of the crimes, okay? But they have to face the facts of history. They have to tell the truth. And that's basically what has to be established, and it has to be done in dialogue with the leadership of the of these countries and you know, with the, of course, obviously the participation of experts. I mean, the institutions that they've created have basically turned into propaganda mills. You have a genocide and resistance research center in Lithuania. You have the Institute of National Memory in Ukraine, the Institute of National Memory in Poland, which have all become basically propaganda mills to produce the false narrative and exclude crimes by the locals and blame everything on the Germans. In other words, in these countries, they talk nonstop about the Holocaust. But what's the Holocaust? Oh, the Germans came and murdered our Jews, Nebuch. So, I mean, this is a very, very important challenge. But it's something that has to be done at some point. And obviously, it's much better to do it through dialogue once everyone calms down a little bit.
If that's possible. Ephraim, I want to ask just one last question before we wrap up. Did you watch the Amazon show Hunters with Al Pacino?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
And is that you?
Not even close.
But what does it mean? So let me ask more seriously, though. What does it mean in 2021 to be a Nazi hunter?
Okay, I'll tell you what it means. First of all, I would say people always ask me, what's your job? How do you do it? It's very simple. I'm one-third detective. In other words, to find the people who are still alive who committed these crimes. One-third historian to find the proof. In other words, documents and witnesses who can help build the case against such people. And one-third political activist. In other words, I have to lobby certain countries to try and create political will to bring these people to justice. And I'm happy to tell you that thanks to a very dramatic change in German prosecution policy and the extension of life expectancy, there are still trials. And as a matter of fact, in less than 2 months, two trials will open up in Germany. One of the secretary of the commandant of Stutthof, a camp where some 65,000 people were murdered, 28,000 Jews. And she was the secretary of the commandant from 43 to 45, at which time there were mass murders of Jews in Stutthof. And another trial of a guard who served 3 years in Sachsenhausen, where several tens of thousands of people were murdered. It wasn't a death camp, it was a concentration camp. Many Jews were incarcerated there on Kristallnacht. But at that point, they were able to leave if they could prove that they had a place to go to. But it was a horrible, obviously, you know, a horrible, horrible place with tens of thousands of victims. So this is part of a new a new policy that was actually created because of Ivan Demyanyuk's case. Mm-hmm. When he regained his, when he was actually stripped of his citizenship again in the United States after being sent back from Israel, the U.S. got a deportation order to Ukraine, Poland, or Germany. And what happened was that in Ukraine, he's actually considered a martyr who's been framed by the judiciary in three Western democracies. By the way, we just did a rebuttal. Is Per Rudling, who's a wonderful professor, associate professor of history in Lund University in Sweden, and I actually wrote a rebuttal to an article that was based on the work of Holocaust deniers in the Journal of Intelligence and Counterintelligence. And this was an absolutely shocking thing that I never thought I would see in a peer-reviewed journal. So this thing just came out now with our rebuttal. And normally, you know, the policy is not to debate deniers, but we couldn't just leave this thing alone. And they wouldn't tell us who the peer reviewers are. They didn't allow us to attack anybody ad hominem or the journal. But truth must be told.
Right. Well, Ephraim, it was a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you very much for being with us. And thanks for what you do.
Thank you for having me.
We're here with Anna Ehrenheim, the Jerusalem Post military reporter, to talk about the events that unfolded in Afghanistan after the U.S. pulled out and the Taliban basically finished its takeover of the country. Many thousands of people trying to get out, and to hear a little bit about what lessons Israel can learn from this. Annie, I don't know about you, but I was just, I mean, watching all of this in abject horror, couldn't take my eyes off of it, but also just, I mean, it's just horrible, horrifying pictures we're seeing from Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. I don't think horrible is actually the right word to use. I mean, it's just, I don't think there is a word, you know, when we saw the videos of the men falling from the plane, it just reminded me of 9/11, of the people falling from the towers, you know, trying to escape, knowing that they would die either way. So which way do you choose to go? And I literally just fell on the floor and shaking my head. And it was just, I couldn't take my eyes off of what was happening. Both as a reporter and as a human being, I needed to witness what was happening. But it's just awful, especially for the women and children in Afghanistan. It's just absolutely awful.
And it's such a sense that like the world is moving backwards, right? It's like 20 years ago, we were hearing about the Taliban, you know, forcing girls into marriages. You can't even call them. It's marital rape. And you thought, you know, I don't know if the problem was solved, but it was at least beaten back. And now it's just like we've gone back 20 years.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, if you look at the villages, and you don't only look at Kandahar and Kabul, there is that support for the Taliban across the country. And that's, I think, partly what helped them retake the country, was that support that you don't hear about, because these are not people that we see on social media or hear on the television or radio reports. But there is that support for this group. And I think that, you know, going back 20 years, I wouldn't really say that, because now you have the Taliban with all the armaments that the U.S. gave to the Afghani forces. And I think that's what's scary, is that now they have their hands on all this advanced weaponry. You have even soldiers who have defected to the Taliban, and you also have soldiers that are regrouping to form a coalition against the Taliban. So you have everything that was bad of 20 years ago, coupled with the advanced weaponry and the training. And I think together with that, plus the fact that we have a whole generation of men and women who grew up with the freedom of, you know, of learning and knowing what was outside in the world, it's just going to be a huge clash.
What I'm curious about, right, is, you know, one of the lessons that we're seeing playing out here, right, is something that Israel has learned over time, which is that, you know, so Afghanistan's not necessarily in the Middle East, right, but it's a country run now being run by this Islamic organization, the Taliban. fundamentalists. So we've seen them in the Middle East. And every time that we've had a withdrawal, whether it was from Lebanon in 2000, then from or even earlier from the West Bank when we started to withdraw from the West Bank under the Oslo Accords, and then what happened from the Gaza Strip in 2005, right? Every time that we withdrew from a place, it doesn't get filled by good guys. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a simple way of saying it, right? You wrote a piece this week that pretty much spelled that out. And I'm hearing from people within the defense establishment who I've been speaking to that, you know, the lesson from this is something that we already knew and we could have told you that this is what was going to happen, we being Israel. But you can't just pull your military out of something that you are a place that you're concerned about will be filled by terrorist elements, because it will be filled by terrorist elements.
Exactly. And I think many people in the American defense establishment were warning the same thing. But if you look anywhere in the world, where has a military withdrawal actually left, you know, a good working democracy protecting the freedoms of every man, woman, and child, especially in the Middle East or in Central Asia, even in Southeast Asia? It's something that, you know, you cannot stay there forever. That's a fact. The U.S. could not have stayed in Afghanistan, but they should have had the proper intelligence and the proper warnings, and given whoever were to come into Afghanistan, you know, now we have the Taliban, but give them the heads up and give the Afghani government the heads up that this is what is going to happen. This is not going to be a democracy. We have propped you up for 20 years. We've given you, I don't know how many billions of dollars of aid and training, but this is what is going to happen. Look at Gaza. Look at the West Bank. The Israelis could have told you that. And the Israelis really, I think, should have really stressed to the Americans, you need to work on your withdrawal plans. You can't just take out your military and believe it's going to be, you know, happy-go-lucky rainbows and unicorns and what have you in Afghanistan. That's not how it works.
And it's hard for me to think that the U.S. was asking Israel's advice on Afghanistan, of all things. So, but I think, I mean, like, yeah, I'm sure Naftali Bennett agrees with that perspective, but I don't know that that was a conversation they were having. But I think that this is going to have really broad implications for how America is seen in the Middle East and in the world, right? I mean, you know, there were 80,000 Afghans who were helping Americans in one way or another, whether they were translators, whether they worked with Americans in different capacities, and they wanted to leave the country, and only a small percentage of them have been allowed out. It's a huge mess. And you have these, you know, the U.S. is basically not backing up the people who it had helped and who had helped the U.S. And it makes the U.S., I think, look pretty weak in the region, and people who rely on America's support, it makes them look weaker. So in that respect, do you think that Israel's in trouble?
I think Israel could fend for itself. You know, should the U.S. Withdraw all of its troops from the Middle East, you know, including Israel, including in other countries that, you know, be it in Kuwait or in places like that where they would come to Israel's aid should we need it, I think Israel could deal itself. But we have to remember, it's not only the Americans who withdrew from Afghanistan. It was a whole NATO coalition. And you had other countries, just like Canada, just like the Dutch, the Germans, the Italians, the Brits, the French. I mean, the Germans left Afghanistan also with a military transport plane, and there were 7 people on board. You know, there was an American, I think it was a Globemaster, that took 800 Afghans, and the Germans took 7. And the Canadians as well, there was a bunch of interpreters who worked for the Canadian Army, and also they're having trouble leaving Afghanistan. So it's not only, I think, the Americans, I think the entire Western world is going to be looked at as countries that cannot be trusted and should not be worked with in the future, in any future coalition, wherever it could be in the world. And I think that's extremely dangerous, and not only America, but just the West in general, is you cannot count on it for support.
Right, but there are countries like Israel, for example, which rely on the United States, and the posture of the U.S. is important, because if America projects power, then that radiates and helps Israel project power, right? So what? I think that when you see the decline of the United States, if that's in fact what's happening, and that seems to be the case, right, then you have a case also of how this could impact Israel. And you know, just reading and following what's been going on in the different analyses and commentaries on the story here, the initial decision to leave, right, was not Biden's, right? That was taken by the prior administration. The question might have been in the implementation of this, right? And I think that it keeps on bringing back the memory of the disengagement from Gaza, right? Where, you know, if I had to compare Biden's speech from a few weeks ago, where he said, we're not going to have those images of helicopters evacuating people, right? And the Taliban are not going to take over that quickly, right? And then that's exactly what happened, right? So if we go back to the disengagement, we had, you know, if they fire one single rocket, right? That was the Shaul Mofaz, who was then defense minister, and Ariel Sharon was then the prime minister. And they didn't fire one, they fired, you know, tens of thousands of rockets, right? And then a year later, a few months later, in January of 2006, after disengagement, Hamas wins the elections. And in the summer of 2007, they basically take over Gaza within the span of just a few days, rooting out the Fatah guys who they're throwing off the roofs of buildings in Gaza, as you'll both
recall. Tying them to motorcycles and driving through the streets, really.
Right.
Yeah, it's very similar to the Taliban.
And Fatah had been this kind of force that, you know, the Americans then came in and they started to train them a little more, but already then they were getting support, and also support from Israel and support from the West. So to me, it very much is kind of like, you know, you have it almost one-to-one of an example of how these things happen. And the world just doesn't want to learn the lessons, right? And I wonder if it could have been done differently. I don't know, right? That's one of the problems with disengagement. I don't think you see anyone pushing you to go back into Gaza, just like probably no one's pushing you to go back to Afghanistan. But sometimes you got to think about how you're doing these things, because you're sending the wrong message.
And maybe a big difference, though, between what was happening in Gaza and what was happening in Afghanistan is that in recent months, the U.S. only had 2,500 soldiers in Afghanistan, which is a fraction of the amount of soldiers they have in places like Japan or Germany, which are obviously very different from Afghanistan, but maybe weren't when the American soldiers first got there, for starters. But clearly, it didn't take such a huge amount of U.S. soldiers to keep Afghanistan at least less of a basket case than it is this week, you know? And that, I think, is the big difference. With the disengagement, you know, there were thousands of Israelis living there, and there was a sense that many Israeli soldiers would have to be there in order to defend those people. And whether that's a good justification or not for what happened, it's different from, you know, a relatively small number of U.S. soldiers that were keeping the whole country from falling.
And I think what's also interesting is, you know, you have Hamas that took how long to take over Gaza, and you have the Taliban, which took how long to take over Afghanistan. And look at the difference in size of territory that was conquered by the Taliban in such a quick amount of time. And the fact that the Biden administration had to bring in how many thousands more soldiers just to complete the evacuation and withdrawal of civilians. And I think that's also something that, you know, needs to be looked at is, okay, you're taking out these many troops, but you need how many troops to secure that withdrawal? Does that make any sense?
Right.
And I think what also Israel is looking at is that, you know, there's also always a talk of withdrawing from the West Bank, and then how long will it take Hamas to take over the West Bank? You know, when Israeli troops pull out, if Israeli citizens are removed, like they were removed from Gaza, how long will it take till Hamas takes over in the West Bank? I think Israel is now looking at that as a really, really worrisome. I mean, they've looked at that issue for a long time. They know that that's what's going to happen.
Former Prime Minister Netanyahu posted something interesting on Facebook this week. He said that in 2013, John Kerry offered to take him to Afghanistan to see how they're training the Afghan army and basically say the U.S. can do the same thing for the Palestinians. And Netanyahu refused. And I was able to independently confirm that this actually happened, and also that they wanted to disguise Netanyahu. So I just like imagine in your head Netanyahu with like a Groucho Marx mask on or something. But, you know, I found that very interesting also in light of, you know, what we've been talking about with Gaza, that, you know, they were already training Fatah and we already saw that that wasn't enough. But the conclusion that Netanyahu drew, you know, was that, yeah, Israel can only rely on itself to defend itself and not going to let international forces sort of be responsible for Israel's security. And then I also talked to Dori Gold, who was the former director general of the foreign ministry, currently runs the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, very close to Netanyahu. And he said that, at that time, when Kerry was talking to Netanyahu about these things, the Jordan Valley specifically was what was coming up, because basically every Israeli prime minister, you know, going back to Rabin, has insisted that Israel maintain its security control of the Jordan Valley, even if there's a Palestinian state in most of the West Bank. And the U.S. was trying to convince Israel to give up on that security control. And I think, you know, I imagine that Biden subscribes to the same ideas as John Kerry. There might be some small nuanced differences, but I think it's this whole situation is going to make it that much harder for the U.S. to push for something like that.
For sure. I think the Israelis will say, you know, this is imperative. We need this area, because it's something that, you know, it could be an attack from Jordan. It could be an attack from even Iraq. Israel needs that.
Yeah, well, it definitely needs the security control, right? And I think that that's the question. It depends who you ask, right? You know, but taking apart the settlement issue from the West Bank and looking at it purely from a military perspective. So the military control is important, definitely over the Jordan Valley, but you could get into questions of, you know, is this settlement important? Is that settlement important? I think that's where you could potentially still have a political debate, but I don't think you'll find, except maybe on the far left, Israelis who will right now, looking at what's going on in the world, say, yeah, oh, we should definitely, now's the right time to pull out of places like the West Bank or the Jordan Valley. Annie, just another question. We already have you with us. The defense budget, assuming that the state budget passes in the next few weeks as the coalition is trying to get it through the Knesset, is supposed to stand at 58 billion shekel, which is just about 3 billion more than the last time it had a budget. It's about $1 billion more. So that's a significant amount of money. Aviv Kochavi, who's the chief of staff, is going into his, he now has about 18 or 17 months left in the role, so 2022 will be his last full year. What are they going to do with this big, sizable pile of cash that the IDF is getting? And should we expect to see any major changes in investments and in preparation? Not because of Afghanistan necessarily, but just because of just looking out at the region today?
I think that Kochavi has made it clear that he wants a lot of changes in the military, a lot of changes that he wrote about in his Momentum multi-year plan. Many of those changes he was not able to get done, be it technological, be it new aircraft, new weapon systems, many, even cyber, especially cyber. He wanted to invest a lot in a multidimensional type of warfare, and that takes a lot of money in terms of connecting and the different core. And I think that what we might see is more of a focus, now that he does have the cash, is a focus of, okay, now I don't need to, you know, take funds from this department and move it over to the ground core. Now he has the funds to be able to do what he wants, to do what he's been wanting to do since he came into his role 2 years ago. And I think that that's something that he could be breathing a sigh of relief. Will we see it implemented and really see it in front of us? I think it'll take time. The military knows what it wants and now has a budget to get it, but it'll take time before we actually see anything. We were able to see in Operation Guardian of the Walls what some of his plan and the divestment of funds from other areas of the military was able to accomplish, be it, you know, closing the circle very quickly on rocket launchers and Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorists who were firing anti-tank guided rockets. I think a lot of that connection, intelligence, a lot of that is going to be something that we will be able to see should we have another round of conflict with Gaza in the coming year.
When I talk to people in the Prime Minister's office about the huge increase in the defense budget, they are very, very focused on Iran. There's mm-hmm. a lot of concern in the Prime Minister's office that the situation with Iran is worse than I guess is public knowledge, or certainly was public knowledge a few months ago, that Iran is getting basically as close to a nuclear weapon than any country that doesn't have a nuclear weapon has ever gotten. And that they're just not, that we're just not prepared enough, that there aren't serious enough planning, and that the government or Prime Minister Bennett wants to, you know, focus on this as much as possible, and this extra funding is needed for that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, if you just look at the situation in northern Israel when it comes to going up against Hezbollah, we're not prepared for that. You know, thousands of Israelis along the border don't have access to a shelter. There's no safe areas for them to run, even in public space. So I think also completing the border fence in Lebanon is going to be a focus. Of course, building and having access like to bomb shelters for the people of the north is also going to be a major focus. Of course, Iran is always the big issue, the big direction where the IDF wants to put its funds. But at the same time, we have to remember we do have threats closer to home, be it in Gaza, be it Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria. That those are issues which I think the military looks at as a more of an immediate risk that needs to be attended to than Iran. Iran does have that, you know, it's going to get the nuclear weapon if we don't work against it, and which Israel is doing in its war between wars, be it the Mossad or whoever. But I think immediate danger is really more geared towards Gaza and Hezbollah.
We'll see how, hopefully the budget will pass, because we definitely do need a state budget, and hopefully the army will prepare for the challenges of the future. It'll be interesting to see how and if what's happening right now in Afghanistan will have some ripple effect on the IDF kind of military build or force build up and planning for the future years. But never a dull moment, not on your beat, Annie, that's for sure. Thank you for joining us in this week's edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be here next week.